America has long been a nation that invited the world's tired, poor, huddled masses. For decades, it even included people fleeing political or religious persecution or deadly conflicts abroad. The Trump administration is changing that with a new cap on the number of refugees that may enter the U.S. each year. On average, the U.S. has admitted about 95,000 refugees a year for decades. Last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the new cap, not 95,000, but 30,000, 30,000 refugees, starting in the next fiscal year, and this fiscal year ends this month. Here's Secretary Pompeo explaining the justification for this reduction.
The total U.S. humanitarian assistance worldwide was more than $8 billion in FY 2017, more than any other country. This year's proposed refugee ceiling must be considered in the context of the many other forms of protection and assistance offered by the United States. Moreover, the refugee ceiling number should not be viewed in isolation from other expansive humanitarian programs. Some will characterize the refugee ceiling as the sole barometer of America's commitment to vulnerable people around the world. This would be wrong.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo explaining the justification for the new cap. What does this reduction in admissions mean for those who seek safety in the U.S.? And how might it change America's culture and its reputation on the world stage? Joining us to discuss it is Priscilla Alvarez, an assistant editor at The Atlantic. Priscilla, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if before we could get to that, I'm still a little shook from the story that we just heard. Could I just ask you to react to that, particularly in the context of this policy shift?
Well, I think the story sheds light on the plight of many refugees around the world who are coming to the U.S., trying to come to the U.S. or surrounding countries. According to the United Nations, there are more than 25 million refugees around the world, and oftentimes they flee to another country and stay in refugee camps until a sliver of them can be placed in another country and resettled in another country. So I think really that story speaks to the stories that we hear from several refugees that are just trying to flee persecution in their own countries and resettle somewhere that is safe for them.
One last comment on the story we heard about Alan Kurdi. Kathy writes, thank you for having your guest. Didn't hear one word about the Syrian people at the UN meeting yesterday. It's so hard to accept that this is the result of Iran, Russia, and Assad. Please let her know that the Syrian people are in our hearts. It is a beautiful culture and country. All Americans do not feel the way our government does. We'll get a little bit more into that perception of the U.S. government as this part of the conversation continues. Priscilla, give us a sense of where refugee resettlements stand in the U.S. this year so far. Is it 30,000? Is it less? Is it more?
So in the last fiscal year, the administration put a cap at 45,000 refugees. So I want to be clear about this cap, because oftentimes administrations have looked at this cap as a goal, as something, as a number they want to reach. And we saw that under the Obama administration most recently, for example. So when they had a cap of, say, 85,000, they came very close to admitting that many refugees. The difference that we're seeing this year is that while the administration put a cap of 45,000 refugees in fiscal year 2018, only around 20,000 refugees have come in. So that's just a reminder that the cap is not something they must do, but it's something they could do. And what we're noticing now is that they are far below the number that was originally intended, which was that 45,000. These are numbers as of August 31st, so we're not sure how many refugees have come in September quite yet, but it's far below what we expected to see at this point.
Much more we want to discuss with Priscilla Alvarez, assistant editor at The Atlantic, particularly where the U.S. stands in terms of refugee resettlement. Are we a primary source of resettlement, or are we just part of the larger picture? We'll dig deeper into what this new policy might mean going forward, and we'll get to some more of your questions and stories as well. By the way, just a quick heads up, tomorrow we will be following the latest hearing regarding Judge Brett Kavanaugh. We welcome your questions and thoughts about that as well. We'll get to as many of those as we can tomorrow. Feel free to leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Stay close. We're talking about the refugee experience on today's program. Earlier, we heard from a Syrian woman who works with refugee children in camps around the world and who's worked to get her family to safety from her war-torn homeland with some pretty tragic results. Now we're discussing America's role in the global effort to resettle refugees from places like Syria. Priscilla Alvarez, assistant editor at The Atlantic, joins us to discuss it. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the Trump administration's new policy on refugees, including the annual cap on how many may enter the U.S. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, especially if this new cap affects you or your community directly, if you have a personal stake in this. 1A at WAMU.org is our email. Still getting some comments from you about the story of Alan Kurdi. Shannon in White House Station, New Jersey writes, "When I saw the photo of Alan, it was like a burning bush. It was as if God was shaking me by the shoulder and shouting at me to do something. Soon after, I joined the efforts of the Sisters of St. Joseph, helping to resettle refugees. Tima, I'm so sorry for your loss and your family's loss. Alan was truly an angel." Robert tweeted, "My daughter is 4. At preschool, she has made friends with a boy from Syria. He could have easily been another boy on the beach. We shouldn't have to have close relationships with refugees to see their humanity, but I know if more people did, we'd welcome so many more of them." Priscilla Alvarez, let's get back to talking policy for a bit. How big a role does the U.S. play compared to the rest of the world in resettling refugees? Do we take the plurality of them, the majority of them, or are we just kind of a little piece in a much bigger puzzle?
So over the years, the U.S. has really led in refugee resettlement. We are a fairly big country compared to other countries in surrounding regions around the Middle East. And so we have historically led and kind of held that leadership role in a way, not only bringing in refugees, but also leading and guiding other countries to do the same, to sort of follow in those footsteps. Now, when you think about per capita, and this is something that comes up a lot in research, when you think about our population, we're not taking in as many refugees as we could, but we've certainly been a leader, and we have resettled millions of refugees over the years.
We played a bit of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo when he announced the new refugee ceiling. What else is the Trump administration saying about the rationale for this cap, particularly the timing of it?
So they're talking about other humanitarian efforts that we have around the world, which is true. But the refugee aspect of this is important because while it's also a humanitarian effort, it's something that we are use for foreign policy. It's a way of sort of showing that leadership role across the globe. So a lot of concerns right now are, what does this say about who we are in the grand scheme of things when it comes to humanitarian efforts and refugee resettlement? When you think about Canada, for example, which borders with us, they are going to possibly take in more refugees than we will in the upcoming year, assuming that trends hold and we take in less and less. So the idea is that we already do a lot around the globe, and it's just part of this broader effort by the administration to crack down on illegal and legal immigration, which is what this would fall under.
Give us a sense of what this resettlement program looks like today. Where do most of the refugees who come to the U.S. come from? I wonder if that's been affected at all by the Trump administration's travel ban.
So the top 5 countries that refugees have come from over the last 2 years has been Congo, Syria, Burma, Iraq, and Somalia. And yes, you're right. The travel ban did affect this slightly by adding more processes that these refugees had to come through. But generally what occurs is that they apply abroad to come to the United States, and they go through several screenings, medical screenings, security screenings, et cetera. And when they come to the U.S., it is upon 9 resettlement agencies are tasked with placing them around the country and sort of helping them get situated wherever they may be. So it's a very, very long process. I talked to a refugee a few weeks ago that was in a refugee camp for over a decade before he came to the United States.
A decade?
Yes.
What made the difference in terms of him finally being able to get out of that camp and come to the U.S.?
Well, the difference is, it's not necessarily a difference. It's just the process and how long it can be. So if they're in a refugee camp, they're out of harm's way. And only a small amount of refugees are actually resettled to another country. They can stay in these camps and sometimes go back home, or those that can never go back home will be placed elsewhere. And so in his case, he had to go through the entire process, which, remember, you have to go through several screenings, and refugee adjudicators from the U.S. actually interview in person every refugee that does come to the United States. And so all of this can take a very long time. And so he did eventually come and resettle. He resettled in Maryland. But it just kind of spoke to how long this can take and just what they're trying to flee and the circumstances that they're in.
Do we prioritize refugees from certain nations higher up in the list, or is it just purely first come, first serve?
So the Obama administration did, I'm not sure if prioritize is the right word, but they did allot a certain number for Syrian refugees. If you remember, during the last few years of his administration, he said that he wanted to admit at least 10,000 refugees, at least 10,000 Syrian refugees because of the Syrian crisis. So there are moments in which a global event or a crisis of some sort will sort of lead an administration to maybe allot a certain number to those people. So that happened under the Obama administration. And the thing with the refugee admissions is that it changes every year. So it's incumbent upon every administration to set that cap and that ceiling. And that can really be influenced by global events around the world. And so, like I said, with the Syrian crisis, we sort of upped the numbers year by year, recognizing that there was a large number of people that were fleeing that country.
Let me get to some more of your comments about this. Chris in Shepherdstown, West Virginia writes, "The administration's actions to restrict admissions of refugees to historically low levels strikes a critical blow to American greatness and reflects economic malpractice as well. From Albert Einstein to Gloria Estefan, refugees have enriched our science, culture, and society in innumerable ways. We will pay dearly for such short-sightedness." And with regards to Syrians, I think another one we add to that list is Steve Jobs, whose birth father, I believe, was from Syria. Michael writes, "The federal government is $22 trillion in debt. U.S. infrastructure needs addressing. Large cities are plagued with crime and poverty. Over 13% of those living inside U.S. borders are born outside the U.S. With so many internal problems to address, is it really hard to comprehend why so many are calling for a timeout on new arrivals to the USA?" Priscilla, before you answer that, two bits of context. One, crime in large cities over as a trend is actually down and not up. There have been years of upticks, but if you look from the 80s to now, that's not true. It's not plagued, although there are upticks. But two, Michael is correct about the federal debt. His number's a little high, but according to the U.S. Treasury, the debt at the moment is $21,475,519,000,000 approximately. With that said, Priscilla, what about Michael's point in terms of the U.S. having other needs that need to be addressed other than refugees?
Sure. So I want to sort of make two points here, which is when refugees do come to the U.S., when they're admitted and they're placed for resettlement, the nine agencies that do work and do this, that resettle the refugees, they receive funding from the government, but they also have their own private funding. And a lot of the services that they offer to help refugees get placed does come from them. So the government will give them funding for, I believe, a few months to sort of get settled where they are. But then really a lot of services that are provided come from these agencies that will have their own private funding as well. And the other point I want to make, too, is I have been talking to these resettlement agencies, and I've been talking to those that provide career services, and they have strong relationships with employers. And these are employers that are employing U.S. citizens as much as they are also employing some refugees. And what is starting to happen now is, which has not happened before, is that they are having a hard time actually filling some positions. And the positions I'm talking about are working at a plant, working as a concierge at a hotel. So really, like, starter level jobs, and they don't have people to fill those jobs, and they often seek refugees because they come to the U.S., they need a job, and you know, by and large, they are pretty committed to that job, and so now they're sort of having trouble with that. So this has ramifications across the board when you're admitting fewer refugees, and they are helping in certain aspects of the U.S. economy.
I wonder, we have gotten some comments, though, also about how many people we actually have room for. Melissa tweeted, "Immigration is good only when well-regulated. We're a country of laws, and we must control our borders. While we feel compassion for all who wish to live here, we must face that we cannot take them all." How are we doing in terms of having room for refugees in the U.S.?
That's a tough question to answer, because I think that there are two sides to that. There are people that certainly think we could take more. Again, research has shown that per capita, the U.S. actually doesn't take as many as we could take compared to other countries that are smaller. And then again, there's the other argument that we should be more restrictive in the people that we're allowing in, because, of course, it's not only refugees that we're allowing in, but also legal immigration. There are flows of legal immigration, people coming through visas and other forms to legally migrate to the U.S. So, you know, if we're thinking just about the studies and we're just thinking about per capita, then we could take more. But, of course, we have to consider what resources communities have. Agencies talk to law enforcement, for example, to see how many more people they're capable of having. So it's a tough question.
How much of this has to do with just actual square footage as opposed to having room where people are willing to accept you? Like, maybe there's square footage in the U.S., but the people who live there just don't want refugees.
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, again, talking to the researchers that I've talked to, there is room for more. But that is, I mean, you still have to regulate and you still have to have enforcement in those communities. And so there are still discussions that need to be had with communities themselves to see who they could take in.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Barlanon wrote on our website, the1a.org, "What needs to be justified is a policy of admitting any refugees. They either work and drive down wages for mostly unskilled American workers, or they don't and have to be supported by taxpayers. If we want to feel good about ourselves, which seems to be the motivation for many people, we do more good for more people by supporting refugee camps close to the refugees' homes." I wonder about that, Priscilla. If you know, what aspects of American foreign policy actually do the most good for refugees or prevent there from being refugee crises? I mean, Secretary Pompeo talked about America being the world's most generous nation in terms of opening its borders to refugees and asylum seekers. Also mentioned there are other things that the administration does around the world. Do we know what actually works in preventing refugee crises?
You know, that is something that is so specific country to country, because we're talking about a lot of these people, actually the majority of these people, are fleeing persecution in their countries. And that's something that comes down from the government. And so and they're not safe in their origin country. And so that is sort of the basis of all of this. And so it's specific to each country. Yes, I mean, you could have the U.S. intervene and sort of try to guide the country in the right direction. But we're also don't want to infringe on sovereignty. And so it's a very complicated question, because we have to think about the ways in which we're infringing, the ways in which we should be leading, and in that grander debate about foreign policy. But I think at the end of the day, what other countries are expecting to see from the U.S. just historically is to take a leadership role in how we should approach refugees to begin with when these crises happen.
One last comment. Katie tweeted, "I volunteer with Syrian refugees in North Carolina. My most special girl is 13. For her birthday, her wish was to return to Syria. However, she said she will never be able to return and that she may never be happy again. She's a tragic example of ambiguous grief, grieving what's not yet gone." Before we let you go, Priscilla, I would like to ask you about a few other immigration stories in the news very briefly. There's a proposal from the Trump administration that aims to restrict access to green cards for low-income immigrants. What does this draft regulation involve?
So the regulation specifically calls out some public benefits, and those we've always had what we've called a public charge rule. So what that would do is if an immigrant is trying to obtain a green card or a visa, the government would consider whether they would be primarily dependent on the government. So this sort of broadens that definition to say that immigrants need to be completely self-sufficient if they're seeking a green card or a visa to come to the United States. Something I want to be clear about is that this is a draft regulation. It still needs to go into the Federal Register, and then it will be open to 60-day public comment. So we're not close to this actually being implemented, but what it does do, which is different from before, is add more public benefits that if you are have used or if you will be perceived to use in the future could affect an immigrant's application.
And of course, I can't let you go without asking about the plight of migrant children on the U.S.'s southern border. Can you give us an update on how many children remain separated, how many have been reunited, where that process stands before we let you go?
Yeah, so we still have children that are separated. I haven't checked the latest figure today, but what has happened is that some parents were deported, and so those parents are separated from their children now in a separate country. The ACLU, as well as other immigration lawyers, are trying to help reunite them, but it's become a lot more difficult now that they are in a different country. And what we've noticed is that the way that they were put into the system didn't quite make it clear how many were, the information of the parent and the child. So this is still an ongoing process, and there seem to be efforts to reunite because some families have been reunited, but this story is not going away anytime soon.
Priscilla Alvarez, an assistant editor with The Atlantic. Priscilla, as always, thanks for talking to us.
Good to be with you.
Remember, you can connect with us about upcoming episodes and debates online at the1a.org and click Ask 1A. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org, and click on Ask 1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow from KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. This is 1A.